Welcome to Victoria Rumble Room, an island show that likes to shift its glaze around issues both locally and internationally, but always from a Canadian perspective. I'm Robin Adair, and my co-host with the most, John Jurisic, is right here. And Johnny, when I say a Canadian focus, well, you know, that sometimes means different things to different people. Because in the opinion of some, at least, Canada is not a so-called country. At least that's what we heard. Not a so-called country.
Robin, great to have you back from Mexico. Things are hot there. Things are hot here. Global issues have somehow localized and become very, very intense. And to the so-called person who has referenced Canada as a not so-called country, outrageous that Victoria Councillor Susan Kim signed an open letter generated from the Sexual Assault Center at the University of Alberta. This letter questioned if Israeli women were sexually violated when Hamas fighters marched into Israel, killing 1,200 civilians and capturing over 200 hostages. The university, to its credit, in my opinion, almost immediately fired the director of the Assault Center, and a petition started locally by Janice Williams, a frequent speaker with the Victoria Rumble Room. She is demanding that Victoria Council censure Susan Kim. So what has been the response from Susan and the mayor? Deflect, deflect, deflect.
Absolutely, John. Mayor Aalto, not prepared to take a stand on this one, says she doesn't have all the information she'd need. I don't buy that. And no censure from City Hall at this point. And as for Ms. Kim, she sent out a press release suggesting she didn't actually write the letter. She says she does oppose all forms of hate and oppression and does call for the immediate ceasefire in the Gaza. But there's no apology in any of this. She's not admitting that this was a misstep on her part, poor judgment. So she isn't apologizing for this or her insult overall to our Canadian nation, her fellow Canadians. The letter in question opens with this line: "We, the undersigned residing in so-called Canada." And this was followed by a bunch of talk about settlers and colonialism, colonialists oppressing people, in this case, Palestinians. But the underlying message in this is also suggesting Canadians are doing exactly the same thing with our First Nations, thus a collective guilt. And, you know, this woke kind of thinking totally is the opposite of reconciliation in Canada. We both come to a meeting place and find reconciliation. We don't point fingers. And this is, of course, a terrible conflict in the Middle East right now. I don't think this kind of messaging helps in that regard. And as far as Canada's concerned, I think we should all be very proud to be Canadian.
Absolutely, Robin. And most real Canadians, not so-called Canadians, are very proud. Newer arrivals like my family, several generations ago, recent immigrants, along with people whose families have lived here and contributed to our society for generations, are very proud. Have there been mistakes? Have there been misjudgments? Have there been miscalculations? Absolutely. But name me the perfect country, the perfect society, the perfect person, because we're all trying to do our best in this world. And I think Canadians try harder than all most.
I have to say that Canadians do try hard, and we'll continue to try to be a reflection of that on the Rumble Room. And we're very glad to see that Israel has agreed to at least a temporary ceasefire to retrieve women and children hostages in an exchange with Hamas. And we sincerely hope that this is the beginning of some real dialogue, some real talk, and the beginning of some sort of resolution to this terrible conflict. It's costing so many lives, so many innocent lives, because I believe people have been pushed in front in dangerous places in the Gaza. I don't doubt for a second that Hamas have actually got tunnels and installations under hospitals and schools, and innocent people are trapped in the middle on this terrible, terrible, terrible style of warfare. So we want to see this end, and we want to see peace for both sides. And it's just an ongoing conundrum.
So many underlying currents festering and causing anger and division, especially amongst our young people, that in this instance seem to be stirring the pot, raising the dialogue, protesting. There's a ton of frustration that the cost of living is out of control. I agree. Housing is unattainable. I agree. Rich are getting richer and leaving our younger population in the dust. I totally agree. We've had a comment before from Constantine Kissin about the shifts in society reflecting these undercurrents. He's a British-Russian intellectual who recently spoke at a symposium in London. He makes a lot of sense.
But as I stand here today, after watching crowds openly celebrate mass murder on the streets of our cities, after watching the police spend more time debating Islamic theology on Twitter than enforcing the law, I'm starting to lose faith. I don't know how long our civilization will survive. For years now, many of us have been warning that the barbarians are at the gates. We were wrong. They're inside. The big debates of the last decade, the culture war, the polarization, are about one thing and one thing only, the future. There are people like us in this room who believe that our future is to be prosperous, powerful, and influential. We are the majority. But there are also some people whose brains have been broken by an excess of education, who believe that our history is evil, that we do not deserve to be great, we do not deserve to be powerful, that we must be punished for the sins of our ancestors. To them, our past is abominable, our present must be spent apologizing, and our future is managed decline. My message to those people is simple. How dare you? You will not steal my son's dreams with your empty words. If I could go back in time and transport the grandparents of your grandparents into this room just four generations ago, they would think they'd been abducted by aliens. That's the progress we've made. We haven't made that progress by whining and acting like victims. We've made that progress by unleashing the creativity and talent of people like us here in this room. I say to our friends in the media, truth matters. We are in the fight of our lives. There is more to life than clicks and downloads. Let's move beyond the culture war, where all we do is bat away the litany of slanderous allegations about our history. Let's set the agenda. Let's remind our fellow citizens why we are where we are. Let's remind them that we are the most tolerant, open, and welcoming societies in the history of the world. We're not embarrassed about our past. We're proud of it. And finally, I say to our friends in politics, many of you here are conservatives. I'm not. I look terrible in tweed. That's why I identify as politically non-binary. But I can tell you conservatives something. You will never get young people to want to conserve a society and an economy that is not working for them. We will not overcome woke nihilism as long as young people are locked out of the housing market, unable to pair up, unable to have kids, unable to plan for the future. I know it's difficult, and I know that whoever solves the housing crisis may well pay the price at the ballot box. This is true of many pressing issues too, or at least you think it is. But you did not get into politics to get re-elected. You got into politics to make a difference.
Well, that's a lot of politics to digest at any time, for anyone, for any community. However, we don't back away from the tough issues and topics in the Rumble Room. We also like to cover lighter topics, you know. If we just stayed in that dark place, it wouldn't be very happy. It wouldn't be very healthy. So let's shift over to something closer to home that takes a lighthearted look at some of Victoria's better known and maybe lesser known landmarks.
Absolutely, John. There's a new book out, 111 places in Victoria that you must not miss. It's colorful, and I think even more colorful, you'll have to agree when you meet him, is the co-author of this book, who we tracked down on his lonely houseboat. Let's zoom in now, Dave Dorge. And now, joining us in the Victoria Rumble Room for the very first time is the co-author of 111 places in Victoria that you must not miss, Mr. Dave Dorge. And Dave, I should preface this whole interview by saying that you and I go back over 40 years. It's
oh my
a long
God.
Time ago that we oh were at God. BCIT and broadcasting together. And back in those days, it's so long ago, even Brian Antonsen was young. He was our early instructor, and he's a big fan of this show. I'm sure he'll be stunned to see the two of us still on the air and looking, well, relatively healthy.
Well, it is 40 years, and I wonder if your co-host John was even born. We're talking about how we're both older than him. I mean, that's 40 years ago is a long time ago, John.
Well, probably, apparently, yeah. I did have more hair, and I don't, and you do.
I've got no shortage of it. I find that in my mid-60s, it grows like weeds. Get with it. You got enough seeds there to get it going.
Yeah. I think John was in reform school, honestly. But, you know, I should preface in our introduction to have Dave Dorge on the show, that Dave has a long background after broadcasting in sports marketing, very strongly involved in sports. And the Olympic Games was a very, very big place in Dave's resume, as he was involved in a number of Olympic committees in Salt Lake City, Vancouver, of course, and London. And a long and fascinating career. So great to have you on the show.
Thanks, Robin. And we're old buds, go back a long ways. It's great to meet John, too. So this is going to be a lot of fun. I'm looking forward to it.
Fabulous.
A wonderful book you've written, and a lot of fun to go through it. A book that you wrote with Graham Menzies. He's your co-author. Yes. And it's not your first book. It's the third in this series. You've already written 111 places that you cannot miss in Vancouver, and then you followed up with 111 places in Whistler. So now it's Victoria. Why Victoria? What was the prep and the work that went into this and collecting the stories that had to go along with these 111 recommendations?
Well, first of all, to back up a little bit, it's a series of books published by a German company called Emmons, and it would be a series of guidebooks. So they have 111 New York, they have 111 Miami, Paris, Rome, Vietnam, whatever, all over the world. And they asked us to do the Vancouver book, Graham Menzies and I, for 4 years ago. It takes about a year to write a book like that. We did the research, the photography, and we're both frustrated writers. We both were getting, you know, manuscripts into publishing companies and stuff wasn't really happening. And so when an offer came to write a legit book 4 years ago for Vancouver, we did it. It was a success. It's just gone into its third printing, the Vancouver book, and it's been translated into German, and it's selling. And so they said, do another book. The Whistler book was a ton of fun. And I spend about half my time in Victoria. My partner Jeannie's in Victoria. I live in a floating home on the Ladner in Ladner. And then I spend time in Machovin with her. And my sports marketing background began in Victoria. For 3 years, I worked full time on the Commonwealth Games in 94. So Victoria is my second home. And I feel like I know it well. And the book was a ton of fun to research and write. And it's our baby. It's just been born. It's like, it takes about a year to make one of these. It takes 9 months to give birth, or to the gestation period of a child. The gestation period of a book is about a year, working pretty hard and hitting deadlines and rewrites and working with editors and publishers. And we're really proud of it. It's got lots of nice color pictures in it. Yeah.
Yeah. Welcome, Dave, to the Victoria Rumble Room.
Rumble on.
Quite fascinating, the interlocking worlds for all of us. Robin's been sports, a reporter. No sports very well here. You're marketing. I worked with Hugh McDonald in sport host.
Good heavens. Hugh and I worked very closely on the, Commonwealth Games. I think he was with CPR at the time.
Yesterday at Save on Foods. He's still kicking around. Nonetheless, another day.
Really liked him. Wow, cool.
Nonetheless, I'm glad you mentioned that. I love the fact that you have fascinating stories to attach to the landmarks. I mean, it's great to say, hey, here's something that perhaps someone hasn't seen, but then there's a story making it even more robust. And, you know, there are stories here that I've not even heard, and I've been around Victoria for quite a while. Why don't we dig into some of those stories? Okay. So okay. Let's give us some background. I found the haunted loo of the 111 places.
Okay.
Is so that a toilet or what's
it's
going
a, it's,
on?
It is a washroom at a pub. And that is one chapter that Graham wrote, my writing partner. And you might just have to buy the book to find out more about that. But the publishers that have done a number of, they're in Germany, as I mentioned, they've mainly done European titles. So they've done Frankfurt and Munich and Paris. And when they hired us 4 years ago, they said, you know, we want quirky, unusual stories no one knows about. And we submitted a 50 chapter ideas, and they came back and they said, these are great. But in every book we've done, we have done a something about a urinal. We want a story on a Victoria urinal. In Vancouver, we found one. We found a twin urinal that was built in 1874 that when you urinate, you look at each other. It's in the bottom of the Heritage Building at 16th and Main in Vancouver. And this one in Victoria, although it's not a well-known story, it is a haunted urinal. And it is in the JBI pub, the haunted loo at the JBI pub. The backstory goes back to the 1940s, ghosts and goblins, and involves Emily Carr and involves a whole bunch of ins and outs in the Hudson's Bay Company. I didn't write the story. Graham Menzies is a fantastic historian and author, and that one is his. But the publishers, they want quirky, unusual things no one knows about. And the haunted loo at the JBI pub is worth a read and worth going to. If you have to go to the bathroom anyways, why not go in there and soak up the history and learn more about it while you're in there? There is some signage there that alludes to when you're in the pub.
And maybe meet Emily Carr. Wonderful stories about better known attractions as well. You've got Bouchard Gardens, Rogers Chocolates, the world's largest totem pole, which of course resides out at Beacon Hill Park. Many people in the community know about these places, but you sound like you found unusual stories about some of these better known landmarks. Do you want to share one of them?
Well, I would say that the totem pole is great, but anytime you, and the publishers also like the world's biggest, world's smallest, world's longest, anytime you make a claim like that, it's up for disputes. And the story about the totem pole is there is a taller totem pole up island. But the one in Beacon Hill Park is the tallest freestanding without guide wires. So I go into a lengthy explanation of what constitutes the world's largest, because there is a larger one that exists. And then the fact these totem poles only live 50 or 75 years. They're made out of wood and they have to be refurbished and taken down for reconstructive purposes and engineering. And the story goes into the claim that it's the largest and the degree of maintenance required. So again, a quirky piece of background information that you might not know about.
Dave, was it tough to choose what to include, what to pass on? Did it have a lot to do with finding the colorful stories? For example, let me give you a few. You include the BC Archives, but not the BC Museum. Hatley Castle, but not Craig Derrick. Was it hard to decide? Like a place like the Legislative Dining Room? Did it better lend itself to a great story? I'm sure there are so many down there.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think we could have done 222 or 333 places on Victoria. I mean, it really was an editing job as to what you want to take out. And the ethos of the book is not to talk about Bouchard Gardens in the familiar sense of a map and you know laying out what people already know, but finding some quirky little thing that nobody has ever heard of, and then really talking about that. So it's a guidebook that's. It wouldn't be like if you're a tourist to Victoria, you should buy it as your second guidebook. You should buy another guidebook, and this is the second one that fills in the backstory on weird things.
Now, you really do get off the beaten trail a few times in this book, which is quite interesting. A lot of people wouldn't think, gee, I really think a great place to go with the family would be to go to check out William Head Penitentiary or, you know, the Sidewalk of Sorrow. I wonder what that's about. Now, the Lego Hotel, the kids might like that if they can find it, but I can't imagine there's huge tour groups going to check out David Foster's childhood home. However, these are all listed. How did you find stories for these things?
Well, you know, you and I have been around for so long, and David Foster was a huge star. You know, it's cool to know that he came from Victoria, but where in Victoria? And it's really easy for one of your viewers to pick up a copy of the book. We got the address. Go buy the house. There's an anecdotal, sort of recollection of his childhood in the bedroom where he had the piano. And it's really, really cool. So that was the mandate, to get a book that locals would love because it gives them information they don't have, that tourists would pick up and get more out of a trip because it's quirky and weird and off the beaten path.
Yeah. How about the penitentiary?
Well, the penitentiary, I mean, you know, the nickname Club Fed, I mean, what a great name, you know, taking off on Club Med. But that's some of the most beautiful real estate in Western Canada out there, you know, in the points of Metchosin. And I've been there. So we're going there soon for a play. I mean, I go there every year when they open it up for a theater production. I'm really interested in it, but I'm interested in why is it there? And when, you know, when land was cheap, and it was a place where, it was a hospital where people were brought sick and infirmed, and it was a quarantine area. People were quarantined there in the 1880s, and that led to it being another institution and eventually a prison. But it's worth the drive. I mean, that one, it's hard to get into. Ha, ha, ha. But it's worth the drive out there.
And I could have given you a good story from William Head, and you're going to go see a play. There was a performance a number of years ago of Macbeth. And they actually walked out and they had a coffin, which the king was supposed to be placed in. And then they took the coffin off stage and two guys took the coffin, went out and used it to escape from the prison. They were rowing themselves out and they didn't realize that the water didn't flow into the beach. It flowed out into the bay. And they were saved by the Coast Guard because they were stranded out there. And for the rest of the productions, they had to drill holes in the casket so it couldn't be taken for that use.
I wish that I had had that for the book. That would be a great paragraph when you're talking about this penitentiary. And it is, although not on the tourist attraction map, it's worth the drive and it's a cool story. I mean, houses down the way, there was one listed for $15 million, a waterfront home. And I don't think there's a prison anywhere in North America that would be next door to such a lavish, upscale neighborhood. They're usually out in the middle of nowhere in a desert, you know?
Yeah. But, you know, I also have a penitentiary story. My son played softball on a team that played the prison team. And so I'm sitting on the benches watching this, feeling a tad bit uncomfortable because I'm surrounded by prisoners. And the fellow who sat right beside me was a very famous bank robber. And then wrote a book about it. And he sits beside me and proceeds to spend the entire game talking to me. And I'm getting increasingly more uncomfortable. And then at the end wants to get my contact information. I'd rather read about it in your book. Nonetheless, here we go.
That's a great story too.
So, likely unaware from our close to now, well, over 1.4 cumulative, 1.4, I keep saying Robin Wrong, 1.4 million cumulative viewers of the show, they likely are not thinking that I'm an avid bicyclist. I bike as much as I can. I clearly like to eat as much as I can. But nonetheless, I was so pleased to see that you included the Galloping Goose Trail in your recommendations. I understand you are a major cyclist yourself. Have you actually ridden up to some of the places you reference, like the Malahat Skywalk, Goldstream Park, Fisgard Lighthouse, to do your research?
Yeah, rode my bike to pretty much all of those places. And I think another story, John, is about the bicycle counting machines in Victoria. When you cycle through Victoria, there's counters everywhere that digitally. And I wrote a story about that. And Victoria is rated as the number one cycling city in North America by what? I think it's a real estate company, Redfin, or some real estate company that, you know, worries about this kind of stuff. And, you know, it just is so wonderful. The Galloping Goose is quite flat because it used to be the railway. The Lochside Trail is absolutely gorgeous. So in our Vancouver book, A Great Cycling Path is the Seawall. In our Whistler book, The Valley Trail, and the Victoria's got the Galloping Goose, which I think is some of the best cycling, and the Lochside Trail. And I've cycled them all. You know, I love cycling in Victoria.
You know, it's really cool how you found so many unexpected places. And we could just talk about that, I think, in the entire interview. We have, for example, and I think you actually placed the head on top of a body that was standing in front of the gates, but you have Prince Harry
standing
in front of the gates of the house out in North Saanich, where he and Meghan Markle holed up for a while in Saanich while they were deciding whether they're going to stay in Canada before they blasted off for Hollywood. And I don't know if it was fame or infamy once they went to Hollywood, but anyway, they were in Saanich for a while, and you actually show the house and talk about the fact that that was the great escape for Prince Harry. And you also talk about the 1994 Commonwealth Games, which you referenced at the beginning of our discussion. I was a TV reporter at that time, and you talk about a missing Inner Harbor stage. I don't have any recollection of that. And you've got a story attached to that as well.
Well, just really quick, I'll comment on both of them because they're interesting. So really quickly, the Prince Harry one, you know, and the that whole thing. But that was short. It only happened in Victoria for a couple of months, but it was intense. Mm-hmm. Paparazzi was there. The world were watching when they hit out there. And, you know, we couldn't get inside of the gates, you know, to photograph it properly or on the beach, you know. So we were restricted to the entrance. So we got a fake Harry mask and put it on and took the picture. But while we were there, some neighbors were walking by and they said, yeah, it was really interesting to live here at the time. You know, people were camped out and there was satellite feeds coming in and out and helicopters. And, you know, many people might wonder, where is that house? Well, it's really easy to get to when you drive off the ferry. It's less than a 3 or 4 minute diversion. Why not go have a look, you know? So that was a fun one. But the Commonwealth Games, I mean, what an amazing event. I love the Commonwealth Games. They're friendly games. They're the right size. They're less political. They're the true spirit of sport. And in my intro, you mentioned that I've spent a significant amount of time working on Olympic Games around the world. But I cut my teeth on the Commonwealth Games in Victoria in 94. And just really quickly, there's two aspects to games from my point of view. There's bids, where you go to win the game. You make promises to the governing bodies that we're going to hold the games here. And then once you win them, you execute them. So they're different committees, different dynamics. I've worked on both. I worked on the Vancouver Olympic bid, and I worked on the London Olympic bid, as you mentioned. But the Victoria bid, we were bidding against Cardiff, Wales, and New Delhi, India. I don't know if you remember that. But that it was a big deal. If you want to hold the Commonwealth Games, you present your proposal to the Commonwealth Games Society. They vote. And Cardiff has a good proposal. New Delhi has a good proposal. They want it. We want an edge to win it. So the proposal stated that every night we're going to bring all the people that won medals from all the different events together in the Inner Harbor. There's going to be scaffolding built up around the Empress Hotel and in front of the legislative buildings, you know, for seating. Seat 20 or 30,000 people there. I mean, you know, that's a big area. And we're going to have a floating stage where we'll present the medals. So, and that was the presentation that helped us win. Now, I wasn't involved in the bid. I was only involved in the games, but I read all the documents. When I got involved in the organizing committee, it was reviewed, all the costs to do this. And at one point, we said, whoa, we can't afford to do this. It's too expensive. Now, there were no repercussions. They're not going to take the games away from you. But it's a very little known fact that nobody would know about it unless you had worked on the games like me. And the games were a huge success. No one missed the floating stage. But that's the first chapter in the book. There is a lovely plaque down there in the on the causeway that has the 44 or 45 flags of the Commonwealth and the logo. And I write a story about, you know, the stage that never was. But, oh, you got the Saanich pool and you've got the cycling velodrome and a lot of other wonderful legacies left behind. Yeah.
And I just want to touch on that a little bit more before we let you go, Dave. The Commonwealth Games, of course, a huge legacy for Victoria. And since that time, we haven't really seen Commonwealth Games much in this country. They tried a few years ago in Halifax. There was a bid, but they withdrew. And I think it went to Edinburgh instead at the end. And the question I have is it getting so expensive now to run a games like the Commonwealth Games, even let alone the Olympics, that a city the size of Victoria can no longer manage it?
You know, Robin, it really is. And the next Commonwealth Games are supposed to take place in the Gold Coast, Australia, I believe in 28. And they won them, and they're halfway through organizing them, and they gave them back. They said that we, you know, we can't afford to execute it and to continue, which is really frightening when that happens. And then I got a call a couple of months ago. Alberta was bidding for was considering a bid for 32 games, I believe. I might get getting my dates wrong, but it was going to be a joint bid between Calgary and Edmonton. And the reporter from the TV station there called me up to do an interview, and the number was 1.8 $1 billion, which would the province decided not, that is, they didn't pull out of the bid, they decided not to bid, which is different. And I just said to the reporter, I said, those are Olympic sized budgets. And is it necessary to rebuild everything? Why can't we stage the games in a more modest fashion, not have to build these mega theaters for sports, and choose cities like Vancouver to do the Olympics again at? You know, so I think that under the current model of the spending that takes place in these massive budgets, yes, Victoria is being outpaced and cannot afford it. But I question how the Commonwealth Games are going to continue when they've a gut punch of somebody giving the games back and nobody's stepping up for the games after that. You know, it's the golden years of bidding for multi events and huge budgets are, I think, behind us. You know, I'm sad to say that.
But all the money that people save, now they can go out and buy your book. That's the good news. And we're getting close to Christmas. It's on sale at Victoria bookstores far and wide across the province. And it's even on Amazon. You can have one of those Amazon trucks drive up to your place and dump off your books.
You know, you and I learned promotion back at BCIT, back in shameless self-promotion. And I don't mind saying that in bookstores now, available wherever fine books are sold for $29.95.
You could be doing one of those 500 funny car commercials or something.
That's 64, just great. 64 funny cars.
Yeah. 64, 101 funny cars.
The raceways out in Victoria. Is it Western Raceways? Western Speedway. I thought that would be a great story. Went out there, started doing the research, compiled it, and then, we're shutting down. Oh, okay. We had quite a few of those places that were going to shut down or did shut down because tail end of COVID. Yeah.
You just got to love Dave Dorgey, and we're so glad that we had a chance to have him on the show. It's kind of a build-up to Christmas to have some positive news, and we'll make a Rumble Room recommendation to buy that book as a Christmas gift for somebody.
Absolutely. Well
and,
done.
With that said, John, it's now the end of another Rumble Room.
Yeah, and you know, we had Santa show up unexpectedly last year, and I think that he might, or she, whomever, depending on your viewpoint, show up at this year's December's Rumble Room soon enough. So good to have some jovial topics. Really appreciate David. We're so pleased to have all of you folks join us weekly as we deliver these issues, ideas, and hopefully some colorful commentary. You know, we've been close to now 1.5 million views since you and I, Robin, started this little project 2 years ago, and want to encourage everyone to follow our program on the following places. We're all over the place, and we are picked up all over the place, and we are commented on all over the place. Facebook, Twitter, X, YouTube, other Facebook news groups, TikTok, and Instagram. There you go. And for now, I remain John Jurisic, the Don Juan of electric cycling.
And I'm Robert Adair, and pleased to see you still, John, cycling on the straight and narrow as we rumble on.